Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Brought to you by Trans World Antennas, Heil Sound, Gigaparts, PMC Science, Tux-Support.com, Markham Street Films, and Martin Lynch & Sons, your European distributors for the finest in amateur radio equipment. This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC.
Our guest is Don Keith, N4KC,
and I don't even know where to start with this fella. Don, is there anything you haven't done?
I'm going to keep trying till I get something right.
I guess one place to start would be your entrance to ham radio, as to how you got into ham radio and what sparked your interest in the hobby.
You know, I grew up in a very small town in rural Alabama, and we just happened to have a ham there in Elmer who started a little amateur radio club in that tiny little town, and we ended up with about 35 or 40 licensed hams and in a town of less than 1,000 people. And I'll forever be grateful to W4OXU, who actually worked for the space program in Huntsville, Alabama, but he lived in a town that was over 100 miles away. He commuted every day, so he spent a lot of time on his mobile rig. But I was always interested in broadcasting. My dad was a TV repairman. I used to hear him very early in the morning. He would get up and turn on the old AM radio and listen to Cincinnati and Dallas and St. Louis and New York, and it was just fascinating to me that you could hear those signals from that far away. Then in 1957, he had an old shortwave receiver, and we heard Sputnik pass overhead. And just the magic of that just grabbed me. So I got my license when I was 14 years old, and have been a ham now for 47 years.
That's marvelous. That is so cool. Now, let me say this. This fellow is an author. You've written, how many books have you written?
I actually got 18 in print right now.
And, you know, in looking at these books,
a good portion of them, I mean, almost all of them, have nothing at all to do with ham radio or broadcasting. I know you just got done telling me before we got on the air, you'd written a book about radio DJs called Wizard of the Wind. And is that about as close as you come to amateur radio and radio in general as far as your writing is concerned?
Yes, and understand I spent 22 years in broadcasting, did practically all of that on the air, almost all of it doing morning radio, which is a good time if you're in the business. But I started writing after I had left broadcasting, and the first novel was about a young man who wants to be a linebacker, played college football, and knock down quarterbacks and make them bleed, but he also loved Shakespeare and romantic period poetry, so I got him involved in all sorts of situations. But the second one, it was actually one I had written well before the first novel that got published, was about a radio personality, a guy who just, as a young kid, always wanted to be in broadcasting. And he finally got into it for all the right reasons, and then he got corrupted by the money and the power and everything else. But one of the key characters in the book is a ham radio operator, and he actually uses some of his the things he learned as a ham to save the guy's bacon toward the end of the book.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though. I guess what I find interesting is the fact that you're writing novels and you're writing all kinds of books here that are so far removed from that, and yet you're versatile enough to be able to, you know, to pull this off. I mean, most of us get stuck in one area, you know. So if I were to write a book, it would have to be something about the radio business. I can imagine writing a novel, you know. But that's such diversification. Now you've done morning radio. In what markets did you work? I know you worked in Nashville.
Yep, I worked in Birmingham, Alabama, Nashville, Tennessee. I owned a station for a while in Mobile, Alabama, and ran stations in Nashville, Knoxville, Birmingham, Mobile. And then I worked for the company that does radio ratings, the Arbitron Company. Worked with them for several years, and finally got out of that business completely.
Did you work in Maryland at that time?
Actually, I was based in Birmingham, Alabama. Arbitron has a software facility here, and I was working for a company that did software for media, and Arbitron bought us. But I spent a lot of time in Maryland and New York and Los Angeles and Atlanta and Chicago and exciting places like that.
You know, I'll tell you something, and for folks that are, if you're into amateur radio, you may not know this, but of course radio stations live and die based on Arbitron. And Arbitron goes into a market, and they survey that market and come up with who's listening and when they're listening and how old they are and what kind of coffee they drank and what color their hair is. it's broken down to the point now where a station can subscribe to the service, and they can come up with the fact that they're number one between the ages of 18 and 19 in female Martians or something. I mean, it's just, you can break it down any way you want to. But one of the things that was so interesting to me when I was in the broadcasting business is I went to Beltsville, Maryland, and I read the diaries for a station that I worked for. And, wow, talk about an education. That told me more. I mean, people live and die by these books, but boy, when you read the diaries, you get a whole different feel as to what's going on, you know, or why the station is missing it, or why you're hitting, what your strong points are, what your weak points are. You know, and I don't think very many people in the management business or in the programming business actually get to do that, do they?
Right. No, they don't. And what people don't understand is millions and millions of dollars in advertising money is spent based on those ratings. And you have to trust in their accuracy, and they're using a methodology that goes back to the stone tablet, I guess. That's asking everybody in a family to keep a diary of their radio listening for a week. Now, I had the pleasure of being at Arbitron during a time when they were developing, and you more technical folks out there in the audience might appreciate this, at a time when they were developing a totally new way to measure radio listening. And that is a little device called the personal people meter, where it looks like a beeper. For those of you who remember what a beeper was, that you would wear on your belt or a lady would carry on her purse, and it can actually tell which radio station you're listening to, and it keeps track of your listening throughout the day. It actually can measure any medium that has an audio source. It could measure television or cable or internet streaming or whatever. But right now it's only being used for radio. But there is a tone, not subaudible, but there is digital information that's encoded into the program material on the radio broadcasting station. It's actually at the transmitter for the station. So the little device picks that up. And it's by far the most accurate way of measuring listening ever. And of course, it scares commercial radio to death because it's different.
This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSL. Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
That does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mama!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen. Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert, cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to the vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big Gate CKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big Eight from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big Eight, is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW, the Motor City.
This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC.
You know, I was going to say, because most radio stations, I think ratings are skewed by this means, and that is the average person, the average listener, is probably not apt to fill out a diary. I think that a person that fills out a diary fits into a completely different category than the average Joe. Am I correct in assuming that?
No, you're absolutely right. And that's my opinion. It just happens that has always been the best way they had to do it. But if you went to review those diaries, you probably saw the same thing I used to go when I would go for my stations or when I was in the consulting business. You will see 8 diaries from the same household all filled out in the same handwriting.
Yeah.
Or, you'll see where they indicate they listen to the same station all day at work when we know in reality they probably hit the button or tuned around. Or they listen to the same station all the way to work and then back home from work when we know everybody punches the button. The diary does a good job of measuring who you remember listening to, not necessarily who you actually listen to.
But I guess what I'm saying is that for me to fill out a diary, I would have to have some sort of passion and desire to do it, because what do they pay you, $20 or something to fill the diary out? I don't remember what it
is. Depends on how old you are and what ethnicity you are.
But anyways, it's not a lot of motivation, let's put it. And
yeah, but you're right. And that's why a lot of families will just hand it to the teenage daughter in the family, because she's really cool and she wants to write down these stations, whereas mom and dad don't really care. So, yeah, from that standpoint, it's certainly not accurate. Jobs and money depends on it.
I can remember working for some top-rated stations that you could hardly get the phone to ring by giving the phone number out on the air. Okay,
that's right.
Yeah, and I've also worked for stations that had very little ratings, but yet they could move products off the shelf because people were actually listening to the station. So, I looked at that, and I've considered that over a period of time, and I've come to the conclusion that there really isn't any dead accurate way of actually getting a feel for what's going on. I mean, we look at shortwave, and we say, well, there's no way you can document shortwave, but you know what? The documentation we have for AM and FM, it's better than nothing. I think it does give you a gauge, but once again, it doesn't necessarily reflect with dead accuracy as to actually what is going on in the market. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it's even possible. Maybe that little people thing you're talking about, the people meter,
right?
That would be a dead accurate way, because there's no way you're going to fool that thing. In other words, if you're tuned to a station and it logs it, that's what's going on.
That's the closest way, but in a market the size of New York City, you may have 1,500 people carrying one of those things at any given time, reflecting the listenership of, 3.5-4 million people.
Yeah, and that was something else that got to me, was the consultants in the business. They would say, well, you can't pay any attention to the phone calls coming into a radio station because they only represent X percent of the listenership. And when you sit down and figure out how many phone calls come in during the day and you compute the number of people that call the station, if you recorded every comment and everything, much like Drake did with the hit lines on the RKO stations, you actually are getting a bigger number of people to gauge, even though that's skewed, than you did off of an Arbitron diary. So I used to think to myself, this is crazy. It's nonsense. But everything has gone off the scale as far as broadcasting is concerned. I remember back during the time when the music director's job was to call all the record stores and to call the jukebox operators.
What's a record store? What's a jukebox?
But they did this. There was ways of actually kind of measuring, getting a feel for what was going on. So if you broke a record on the air and then all of a sudden, the record stores, when you call them up and you say, well, what's selling? Well, this is selling and this is selling, but you guys are playing this crazy song and we can't get a hold of it, and people are just blowing the doors down wanting to get a hold of it. You knew right then, you had a pretty good gauge that you were impacting the market and that song was viable.
Well, you know, it still goes back to the fact you have to consider Arbitron ratings. You have to consider people who are calling the station. You have to consider research. But still, the bottom line is, how many cars did you sell? How many six-packs of soda did you move for your sponsors? That's really the bottom line. And that's hard to measure, but that's exactly how the Internet does it. And that's becoming the standard for advertising, is the Internet can target anybody on an individual basis. And you pay the Internet for advertising based on response, on whether people actually perform the action that you're paying them to do. Radio's going to get that model, too.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, you can get so snowed by this. I worked for a station in Flint, Michigan, and I was on a remote. Have you ever done a remote, Don?
I've done a remote where you would take the microphone and clip it to the telephone.
Well, this one, I think, actually, we had to run down to a payphone and pull a 2600 and actually dismantle the payphone in order to get to the pair wires to alligator clip on and feed the remote down the line. I mean, I've seen all this, but I've got friends of mine that used to live at car dealerships. They would do their morning show from the showroom, you know. So
free hot dogs and balloons for the kids.
Yeah. But we were at this mobile home place, and there was nobody coming by. I mean, we were on the air, and I knew that. I mean, we had lots of people listening. But nobody wanted to come into this mobile home place. So the man came to the conclusion that the station was faulty. You know, there's something wrong with this radio station.
Yeah.
So he had a bunch of kids around, and I said, hey, get them together. Let's get some, you know, we gathered up some buckets and some soap and some sponges and some towels. And I said, we're going to go on the air and offer a free car wash. Can we do that? And he said, sure. I said, well, you know, we'll just go on the air and tell the people, come on in, get your car washed. And while your car is being washed for free, you can walk through these mobile homes. And aren't you a little curious as to what mobile homes look like today? How long has it been since you saw a brand new mobile home? You know, of course, needless to say, within a short period of time, we had the Michigan State Police coming by telling us to knock it off because we had cars backed up over the top of the freeway and everything. But you know what? They didn't sell one single mobile home during the time of that remote. Now, we created a lot of traffic. But a lot of that's related to, you know, it isn't just whether or not the guy on the air is selling it or the station has listeners. It's, do people really want this product, you know? And,
right.
That all becomes a very difficult, delicate mix, you know.
I had something similar happen. We were doing a remote at a car dealership, and nobody was coming in because people, unless they're really wanting to come in and look at a car, they're not going to come in just because the radio disc jockey's there. And the general sales manager goes berserk and says, nobody's listened to your station. You don't have any listeners. That's why nobody's coming by. So I tell you what, let's just say on the air, the next person that comes in gets a free car. And he turned white and said, oh, never mind.
That's a classic. And I've heard of that kind of thing before. But I remember in Ypsilanti, Michigan, I was working for a little station, WSDS, of all call letters. And we were at a place called Beverly Furniture. I'll never forget this. And nobody was coming in. Nobody. Absolutely nobody. And they had one of these combinations where you get, you know, a cheap sofa and chair. And I don't know. It was pushing the daylights out of that. And there was no takers. I said, have you got anything to give away? And they started looking around and they found a couple of cases of battery-operated electric scissors. I said, okay, let's try giving these away on the air. So I went on the air and I started talking about these scissors, and I'd hold them up to the microphone and do a little zzz, you know, this is cut through paper, it'll do through fabric. If you like to sew, you know, this is a perfect thing. You know, I did this. And we got stampeded by little old ladies. I mean, we had, I bet you there were 50 grandmas that just come running into that place wanting their electric scissors. Just blew me away. I mean, you couldn't even imagine, you know, that. You know, that's one thing I think I really loved about the business, and it is totally full of surprises. You just never know who you're touching or who is listening. You haven't got a clue most of the time. You think you do. This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 array box in center section only. Right now, only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Trans World Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with the deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Trans World Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Trans World Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040. Have you been looking for a place to put a website? Have you thought about putting your own website up, or possibly you've got your own right now and you're not real happy? The name to think about and remember is Tux-Support.com. Tux like Tuxedo, the little penguin, the mascot for Linux, the Linux operating system. Tux-Support.com. Just remember that name. If you're looking for a website for your amateur radio club, your church, your organization, your business, or even a personal site, you need a place to put that site, and you want a simple way to put it together and maintain it. One word or one company to remember, that's tux-support.com. Tux-support.com. That's T-U-X-S-U-P-P-O-R-T. .com. Tux-support.com. The only name you need to know when it comes to your website. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email, because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? Then what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station, and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
Bundus for Big Tom Rivers, 1971. And Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mother!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen. Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to a vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the big HCKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, The Rise and Fall of the Big 8 from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, The Rise and Fall of the Big 8 is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW, the Motor City.
This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC.
And that's the thing, and we were talking about this before we went on the air. There is something about the medium of radio where you're actually getting in, you're literally getting into somebody's head because you're touching them very personally. It's companionship. I think that even carries over to ham radio in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, it's very strange because I was an only child, and you're going down that road. If you don't have brothers and sisters, life can become a little lonely. I know people have had that have brothers and sisters wish they didn't. You know, all the scrapping and all the things that go on. You know, sibling rivalry and all that kind of thing. But one thing that was really magic about being very young and having an HF rig, well, that is you could go into your room and flip on the transceiver, and I don't care if it was 2 o'clock in the morning. There's somebody to talk to.
Yeah, I hear people say all the time that kids today aren't interested in ham radio because they can talk to their friends all they want to. And there's no novelty in talking across the country because they do it all the time. But, you know, you don't pick up your cell phone and dial a number at random and strike up a conversation with somebody in China or Russia or Czechoslovakia and find common ground with them on the cell phone.
You know, they have the chat rooms, you know, two of my sons, which are both radio engineers, are involved in these online gaming communities, you know. And they do chat back and forth and all that kind of thing. But one of the things is missing, you're right, and that is the ability to meet someone. And there's also something very, very unique and magical about the human voice. The inflection.
Yes.
You get to know a person far better. You hear that voice, and you hear the reaction of the voice to different things. And there's a getting acquainted process that goes on that you cannot do in a chat room. It just isn't possible to be able to catch the inflection and to actually feel what that other person's feeling. You can feel it in a voice. You can hear it and feel it in a voice.
Exactly, and that's so important in communication.
And I think that's one of the things, I mean, we talk about DX and all the different things, emergency operations and all that inside of amateur radio. But I think I said something the other day, and I after I said it, I didn't realize the impact of what I had just said. Not that I have the ability of saying anything too intelligent, but anyways, I said the amateur radio service is only going to be as viable as the fraternity is. As the fraternity goes, will go the service. And when we begin to lose the fraternalism in it, or the fraternalism goes to the wayside with the technical stuff taking the lead totally, I think we'll see a lot of weakness in the service. So I think that's the glue that holds it together. I think the Elmering, you know, you were just talking about your beginnings in ham radio, and you said you wanted to thank this fella, and you obviously have a lot of emotional ties to this guy because he turned you on to something that did totally change the course of your life, you know?
Sure. I mean, this was a man who worked probably 12 hours a day and then drove 4 hours a day back and forth to work, and yet he still took time to teach that ham radio class and get us all licensed. And I don't know when I don't know when he had a chance to operate because he was always doing something with us. He sponsored field day. He took me to Atlanta to take my general class license exam. you know, that's spectacular.
If you want to get something done, ask someone that's busy. I guess that's that's the thing. But yeah, I recall. I don't like to tell my stories too much because I tell them too many times, and people will say, you know, Randall, we've heard this before. Shut up, you know. But I can say this, and that is I was busted doing bootleg broadcasting as a young child in my bedroom in the basement by all people, the main man from the Detroit field office of the FCC, a guy by the name of Richard Cotton. And he had a reputation of being extremely stern, you know, like a lot of FCC guys did back then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in short, he let me off the hook. And I won't go into that tale now because I've told it before, and I don't want to tell it again because I'll be bored to tears. But what was interesting is he went to the local amateur radio club, and he told them, he said, make a ham out of this guy. And I must have been, what, 11 years old, 12 years old? I don't know, very young. And that was the Motor City Radio Club in Detroit, Michigan. The call sign of the station was W8MRM. And you talk about some magic. These guys met at the Greenfield Village Henry Ford Museum in the radio section. That's where they had their meetings.
Wow.
And all this old antique radio stuff. And, of course, as a kid, man, the place looked giant. Just recently went back for a visit and visited the museum. And what was a real big disappointment is they had taken all the radio stuff out. Boy, I was just, where's the manager? I want to talk to this guy. You know, but it was, you know, that once again, the fraternal part of it. You know, those guys that I didn't have a father then. My dad had passed away. And those guys did everything under the sun, you know, to try to get me to get licensed. Of course, you know, a kind of a motivation from Dick Cotton was was a little bit motivating, you know. But the thing of it was, is Mr. Cotton was a ham. And when he came into my bedroom and he saw this horrible-looking transmitter I'd built out of a television chassis, I think he saw some possibilities. And he said, you know, we got to get this kid on the right track. And but that's the thing, you know, that's I think is so important about amateur radio and hearing you express that. Now, the other thing you talked about was your dad listening to AM radio. Now, you say he listened to all these stations. Tell me the stations he listened to. I'm gonna guess when you said St. Louis, was it WIL possibly or
WIL and KMOX, WCKY, WLW from Cincinnati, WDFW, who used to share a frequency with I can't think of the other call letters. Big AM station in Dallas. 840.
BAP.
WBAP. Right. Yeah. And WWL from the French Quarter, New Orleans.
Yeah, so my dad used to listen on a little Emerson transistor to those exact stations, and I recall taking the transistor radio to bed with me and having it under the pillow and listening. Of course, I had a shortwave rig by the bed. Now, let me ask you a question. You got into ham radio. Now, how did you get into how did you filter into the broadcasting business? How did all that happen? Give us your story.
It was directly responsible. Being a ham, I volunteered at the campus station, which was a little carrier current AM on 570 at the University of Alabama. And when I mentioned that I was a ham radio operator, they said, sure, come on. Of course, not knowing at the time, if they get anybody to work after 7 o'clock at night as a volunteer, they would sign you up. And that's how I actually got on the air, even though that was one of those stations where I actually got on the air one night and said, the first person who calls, I'll give you $100. Nobody called. Nobody listened to that thing. I also worked in television the same way. That was how I worked my way through college primarily, was this program comes to you from the University of Alabama. And they paid me to do that. I thought, this is kind of cool. But worked full-time radio and part-time television all the way through college. And then from there on, I never looked back. But ham radio was directly responsible for that. And I think a lot of it, I used to worry about ad-libbing, you know, just talking off the cuff. And ham radio had prepared me for that very, very well, because that's what you do every time you're on the air, at least on voice. AM in those days, by the way, I was around for the AM single sideband switchover, and that was a wild time.
I've talked about that a little bit. You know, there was an organization back then I heard about it. I don't know if it was an actual organized planned group or if it was a loosely knit bunch of guys on the air, but they referred to themselves as the NAASSB. Are you familiar with any of that at all?
I vaguely remember that. Yeah, they used to call it Slop Bucket for sideband.
Right, yeah, the NAASSB, the National Association for the Advancement of Single Sideband or something. Mm-hmm. And I never did understand if that was actually a real organization or if that was just a tongue-in-cheek, wolf-on kind of thing. That this week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. It's the 4040. It's a new 40-meter monoband antenna. It looks just like the Adventurer or the TW2010. It's the perfect antenna for high-performance DX communications in a portable package. This antenna system is ideal for camping, emergencies, or permanent installation where you gotta go stealth. 7.0 to 7.3 megahertz. Without the necessity of either manual band changing or the need for a controller. Just attach the feed line and you're ready to talk. That's the Trans World Adventurer 4040. Go to their website. Take a look. Transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. I found this vitamin put out by the Premier Micronutrient Corporation. And it's a different vitamin than I'd ever taken before. Matter of fact, it'll be a different vitamin than you've ever seen. Metabolic has all kinds of things going for it. Number one, first off, it was designed correctly. Not like vitamins you buy in the supermarket or off the shelf. It's known that water-soluble micronutrients have a half-life of 4 to 6 hours, and fat-soluble constituents have a half-life of 6 to 8 hours. So it only makes sense to maintain a steady state of proper antioxidants in your body, the supplements have to be taken twice a day. There's no other way. You want to take a vitamin that actually makes you feel different? You need Metabolic. Now Metabolic and another formula they make called Veterans Formula, they don't contain iron, copper, or manganese. Now, these minerals are known to interact with vitamin C, and they produce excessive free radicals if they're in your vitamin supplement. And this production of free radicals caused by this combination is in more than 95% of the commercial vitamins that you'll find on the supermarket shelf. It's exactly the opposite of what you want. In addition, these minerals, especially iron, can be dangerous. Because men of all ages and women after menopause don't excrete iron in any significant amount. And that excess of iron in your system causes more free radicals. Diabetes and high blood pressure, that's the formula for you. There's also the Veterans Formula. What you need to do is go to the website and take a look. It's pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. Very simple to remember. Believe me, you take Metabolic or Veterans Formula for 2 weeks, and you will be a different person. Take a look on the website. Go visit the website at pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. These guys had taken on, but boy, that was a battleground back then. I mean, there was some real bitter...
Yeah, it really was from both sides. But I think once people realized, you know, that sideband would let them work DX a lot longer before the band closed than AM would, that sealed the deal. And of course, the equipment got better, the technology got better. But it's still fun to me. I still operate some AM. I've got a bunch of guys we talk with on 160 and on 75 meter, and you know their frequencies set aside for that. And it's a lot of fun. Plus, you know, being an old broadcaster, I like to fool with the audio and get it tweaked up real good so it sounds good.
Well, I heard a guy on 3880, I think it is. Isn't that where the AM window is?
Yeah, that's one of them. Yeah.
And he was on the air, and he was a younger fella, younger than me. And he had just built an AM transmitter that was using PDM modulation. And that thing really sounded good. He had him a Heil microphone on the air, and he was using a broadcast audio processor. And it really sounded great. I mean, you know, I purposely was looking around for a better speaker system to plug into the receiver, which I found and plugged it in, and I listened to it. And listening to those guys, and I'll tell you, there's still some guys on the air on sideband that just absolutely hate the AM people. Man, I mean, they just hate them. But I think it's cool. Now, I don't have a lot of tolerance for listening to AM right, you know, in and out of a thunderstorm when it starts, especially you got weaker signals in there. It's something about it. It's just straining to listen to. But when you get somebody in there that's packing a pretty good signal, that audio is absolutely incredible, just unbeatable. I mean, it's so pleasant to listen to, so musical to listen to, you know, and when you go back to sideband, you realize there's quite a compromise, you know, a lot more than you maybe would think. But once again, you know, it gets aggravating listening to it sometimes. And I mean, you start getting a lot of atmospheric noise. I immediately want to hit the sideband switch and get off onto another frequency where I can actually hear what's going on.
Of course, one of my pet peeves, some of these guys will be in roundtable 7 or 8 stations. They'll be spread out across 15 kilohertz of the band, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of them are using old vintage equipment that tends to drift just a little bit. And but they're still fun to listen to. I enjoy doing it.
Well, isn't the object to run all the way up from, say, 20 to 20,000 cycles of audio? I mean, it's high fidelity, you know. It's too bad
Nobody has a receiver that'll hear it, but it's still there.
So you got into the broadcasting business in college, basically, is what you did. And right. ham radio was the instrument of getting you into that. Well, let's follow the timeline a little bit, because I don't know where all this fits in, but I know you were responsible for WRLT in Nashville coming on the air, because you were telling me about that. But follow your timeline a little further. Let's hear a little bit more.
Yeah, I sort of chased FM around for a while because understand the first jobs in radio were all on AM stations before FM was really that viable. This is in the late 60s and very early 70s. But I came to an AM station in Birmingham, Alabama, because they had applied for an FM license. This was 1970. Well, it took 6 years to get that FM license. And I helped put it on the air at 99.5 K99. One letter, two numbers. One of the early progressive stations where you pretended you were smoking grass, or actually smoked grass on the air. but an extremely influential station. It's the most amazing experience that I've had. I had the pleasures of being in the last of the AM Top 40 wars, where stations literally fought it out over listeners. And then to be in the early days of FM, we gave away FM converters because most car radios couldn't get FM. We had to do everything we could do to get people to switch over to FM. And then did the same thing. I moved to Nashville with an AM station with the understanding that we were going to pursue getting an FM signal there and put a true country FM signal on the air in Nashville. That only took 4 years to get that accomplished. And we put a little station on the air there that it's an interesting engineering experiment because we were a low power, a class A FM, which at that time could only run 3,000 watts at 100 feet. But we put that thing up on a tower at about 1,100 feet, actually 600 feet up the tower, which was close to 1,100 feet above sea level or average terrain. And we ran 200 watts with a single bay antenna. And that high, the angle of radiation, all DXers know about angle of radiation, was so low that they couldn't hear us close by, but you go out 60 or 70 miles and that 200 watts rocked. But it was a fun experiment. We put True Country on the air, and then a couple of the other stations eventually changed over to Country running 100,000 watts right there in town. So that pretty much got us out of the country music business. But it was fun to do country in Nashville. Our studios are right there on Music Row at Music Square East and South Street, two doors down from where John Lennon recorded, where Bob Dylan did Nashville Skyline. You know, you're right there in the middle of all that music history, and that was... I never could get used to coming to work in the mornings or when I get off the air. The Oak Ridge Boys or Barbara Mandrell or folks like that were sitting in the lobby waiting to talk to me.
You know, I think, too, and I don't want to stray too far off the beaten path, But Nashville itself has lost an awful lot of that flavor. You know, it's something about maybe the foreign interest in owning the record companies or something. I don't know. There's something. You drive down through Music Row now, and it's just like driving through any other part of town or in any other city. It just doesn't have that same. There's something used to be. I mean, you drive through Music right down on Music Row, and you go to, down those streets, and there was something almost would call out at you, you know, reminding you that legendary things had taken place there, and legendary things were still taking place.
Yeah, I know we sound like a couple of old curmudgeons talking about the old days and how it was, but that's right. There was a certain feeling. I hate to say it went corporate, but I'm sure that's probably an accurate description. The music industry, of course, there's another industry that's really gone through a lot of changes in the last decade. But, I was on the air one morning, the phone rings, and I, like a good disc jockey, I actually answer it. And the guy says, "Hi, this is Ronnie Millsap. I know you interviewed Ronnie a while back, WB4KCG. He said, "This is Ronnie Millsap." And I said, "Sure you are." He said, "Oh, no, this is really Ronnie Millsap. We're in a studio right up the street, and we're about to master a single. And I wonder, if I brought an acetate over, would you play it on the air so we could mix it so it would sound good on the radio?" I mean, who would do that nowadays? And I said, "Bring it over." And without even listening to it, of course, I put it on the air. And they went back and made a few tweaks on the mix. It was a song called "Any Day Now," which was an old Chuck Jackson song that Ronnie re-recorded, and it became a number one country song.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you know what? This man is a master at hearing. I mean, he can hear anything. Mm-hmm. And it was really weird. I were doing this interview with him. And I don't know if you heard this, but I did the interview with him. And in the interview, I said, "What was your favorite Ray Charles song?" And he starts singing it. You know, well, I didn't think much about it. But then when I got to producing the actual broadcast, I thought, well, I'm going to play the Ray Charles song. So I grabbed the Ray Charles song, and I put it up on the audio editor, and I put it up against where Ronnie starts singing. And it was perfect. I mean, he had the timing perfect. He was right on key. It sounded as if he was in the studio with Ray Charles. It just was perfect, you know. And but that's really a match.
I mean, how many artists would even think about getting a radio station to play something on the air just so it could be mixed so it would sound good on the radio?
Well, yeah, and you know what? There's a lot to that because the audio,
sure,
the audio processing, as you know very well, will take a record that has a pretty flat sound and it changes it drastically.
Yep.
And we know from being on the air, disc jockeys know how important it is to listen to an on-air monitor when you're talking. Because
that's right.
You can become buried, or you can, you know, there's a lot of changes that take place in that audio chain. And
keeps you from, because if you pause, you hear all that limiting and compression sucking up all that background noise.
Yeah, yeah, and it's funny.
It sounds like some of the ESSB guys, you know.
You know, you get to the, you have these people come into the studio. I remember you're listening to the public service programs on radio, and they would always run them Sunday mornings at wee hours, you know, and the two people on the air were working the mics pretty close, and by the time the audio processing got done with them, it sounded like they had overactive salivary glands. You know, you could hear every little, you could hear the food particles in their teeth, you know.
Of course, you hear their tummies growling.
Yeah, you did. We didn't have Heil microphones back then, though. It would have been horrible if we'd had Heils. I use a PR40, and that thing hears everything. It's amazing. Really changed. Well, now, okay.
I use a Goal Line on the air, by the way.
Really? Those just good mics, and of course, Bob is this week on QSO. Our guest is Don Keith, N4KC.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA,
and half a continent.
That does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971. And Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, Bubba!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen. Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert, cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to a vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big Gate, CKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, The Rise and Fall of the Big Eight from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, The Rise and Fall of the Big Eight is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. The Motor City.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Trans World Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email, because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. You're listening to QSO. It's all about ham radio, brought to you by Trans World Antennas, Heil Sound, Gigaparts, PMC Science, Tux-Support.com, Markham Street Films, and Martin Lynch & Sons, your European distributors for the finest in amateur radio equipment. This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. He's a good friend, and the biggest revelation I ever had, and I'll, you know, we're way off track now, but that's okay. was I had the Electro Voice, and I don't mind saying this, the RE20s. I've had RE20s since I can remember those, and the Shure SM7s and some SM5s, and I've got a microphone collection because you become addicted, you know, to this business. And I'm so proud of the RE20s I'm running. I think they probably sound better. And I go to a Heil seminar, and he connects up an RE20, and he starts talking into this microphone, then he switches and goes to a PR30. And I said, no, you know, my son, Matt, was listening, and he said, what did he do to the RE20? Did he drop it? He actually said that to Bob, and Bob almost turned colors. No, I didn't drop it. What are you talking about? You know. So anyhow, I was so amazed. I thought, that can't be. It cannot be that the RE20 sounds that bad, you know. But we plugged in the PR30, then the PR40, and yes, it really did sound that bad. All of them sound that bad, you know. And so he made a believer out of me. But the technology has moved along at such a rate. Because I've even got old 77 DXs in my collection, you know, which are really cool old microphones. And but we've really come along. Now, you got into writing. Now, I went up on your website, and I was looking at all these books you've written. How in the world did you get into authoring books? What got into your head? How did you figure that you'd go down that road, or what spurred an interest?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, because especially back when I was in radio and wanted to write, and it occurred to me that they are actually very similar. Being a radio personality, you spend a lot of time in a small room trying to create something that's going to touch somebody on some level. And once you cast it out there, you can't take it back again. And that's exactly the way it is with writing. You sit in a small room all by yourself creating something that you hope is going to touch somebody on some deep level. And once you get that book out there and it's published and people read it, you can't take it back again. So you pretty much have to live with what you've created. And that similarity, it's something I've always wanted to do, was write anyway. But I was actually doing radio in Nashville, and a friend of a friend of a friend of mine introduced me to an agent, a literary agent there in Nashville. He's got to be the only literary agent in the whole state of Tennessee, I would think. But I let him read some things, and he said, you know, there's something there, but I can't make a living and feed my family by trying to sell this. He's very straightforward. He'll hurt your feelings if you're not careful. He said, but, you know, if you write something else, let me know. So I knocked out a novel that I thought was just great. He read it, and he said, it's not there yet. I can't sell this. But keep trying. Don't give up. He said, if you give up, that just proves that you don't really want to do this. Finally, the fourth book I took him, he read it overnight, called me up the next day, and he said, I know who will buy this. And he talked to a fellow named Robert Wyatt, who was with St. Martin's Press at the time, a legend in the publishing business. Bob bought the book immediately. He called me back that afternoon and said, hey, book sold, you got a novel coming up. Then we went back and we picked up one of the other books that I'd written, which was the radio book, Wizard of the Wind. And he said, do some more work on that. I think I can sell it too. So I went back and practically rewrote the book, and we submitted that. That became the second novel. And once I went to work for the software company, I was spending a lot of time traveling anyway, so I spent most of my time, instead of hanging out in bars or watching TV, I was cranking out novels and books there for the next several years, and have not looked back. I really enjoy doing it. I still do it part-time, and I still have a day job, but I really enjoy people, even my agent says, you know, you really need to settle down on one certain kind of book. And I write about what I would enjoy reading, things that interest me. And thank God there are people out there that are interested in the same things I am, that I've been able to keep doing this, indulging this this conceit of mine.
Well, now you do have kind of a theme. I see Final Bearing and several other books you've written. I see another one called The Ice Barrier, Final Patrol. These all have a common thread. Tell us a little bit about that. And, like, you know, in the Course of Duty, these are all books that have a common thread.
Yeah, I did those first two novels. Then we did a series set in NASCAR racing, and those are all still out there. The Rolling Thunder Stock Car Racing series, which are young adult novels set in very realistically in NASCAR big-time racing. And at that point, my agent, who was an old submariner, called me up one day and he said, you know what, I think I trust you to tell the story of my submarine, the USS Archer Fish. And I said, Robbie, I write fiction. He said, well, this book is stranger than fiction. He said, besides that, Don, you are a storyteller, and this is a story that needs to be told. He started telling me about his experiences in the 1950s on this submarine, the USS Archer Fish. Turns out this is a absolutely wonderful historical thing. The Archer Fish sank the biggest ship that's ever been sunk by a submarine, a Japanese aircraft carrier, the Shinano, coming out of Tokyo Bay on its maiden voyage. An unsinkable ship, by the way. And Archer Fish sinks her with six torpedoes that just happened to be placed just right. She went on to have a 25-year career. She was the first. I compare it to, remember the Woody Allen character, Zelig, where he just keeps popping up in all sorts of historical contexts. That's the way Archer Fish was. She found the deepest trench in the Atlantic Ocean. She allowed some divers to pop out of a hatch the deepest any diver has ever come out into the ocean. All sorts of things. Anyway, I ended up writing that story with a lot of help from Ken Henry, who was also a former crew member on the submarine. And since then, I just keep finding these wonderful submarine stories. In the Course of Duty is about the USS Batfish, which sank three Japanese submarines in 3 days. And we only sank a total of seven Japanese submarines with our subs in World War II, and she got half of them in 3 days. The whole thing, the hook there was, after they had sunk that third submarine, the skipper gets on the announce system throughout the submarine and says, men, we have sunk an enemy vessel. But in our hearts, there's sadness because in the course of our duty, we have taken the lives of fellow submariners. And that was such a powerful, powerful thing. You talk about a close fraternity. Submariners are certainly it. Out of that one little section of that book, I got a phone call one day from a fellow, William Anderson, Captain Bill Anderson, called me just out of the blue and said, Don, are you working on another project? And I said, well, yes, I am. He said, well, stop, because I want you to help me with something. It turns out this Bill Anderson, no relation to Whispering Bill Anderson there in Nashville, this particular Anderson was the skipper of the USS Nautilus, the first nuclear submarine, that went to the North Pole in 1958. And Bill wanted to finally tell the story behind that truly history-changing event of becoming the first vessel to reach the North Pole beneath the polar ice pack. And we wrote that book. It is called The Ice Diaries. And that particular book has been submitted for consideration for the Pulitzer Prize, and we'll find out about that here shortly. But I'm extremely proud of that book because it's an important book. Not only that, it's a great story. Oh, it's a great story of true bravery and courageous men and doing the right thing and following their duty and all that sort of thing. Can you tell I love these guys?
Yeah, I can. You're really, really. That, you know, that's a transition, though, from your background into submarining, you know, and the people who man and the and do the submarines. But, you know, let me ask you this. Don't you find that this is true, too, and that is the real stories behind the submarines are the stories of the people inside the submarines?
That's it. I don't write about submarines. I write about the people who were in those submarines. And they are all such fascinating people. Anybody who would pull that hatch over their heads and dive one of those sewer pipes and go down 600, 700, 800 feet, it's just amazing to me that people are willing to do that and what motivates them to do that and how they perform under pressure. I'm doing a book right now that will be out in 2010 about the USS Billfish, who was under a depth charge attack for 15 hours in the Makassar Straits in the China Sea. During that depth charge attack, the captain and the two senior officers aboard completely lost it. They one of them was overcome by the bad air, and the other two just they couldn't perform. And the fourth in command on that boat, a guy named Charlie Rush, took over and literally saved the ship and the 60 men aboard her just by his quick actions and some of the other things that happened with some of the other crew members. It took Charlie 60 years, but he finally got the Navy Cross for that because he wouldn't tell about the skipper and who wanted to surrender, by the way. But we're going to tell that story because it's a true story of courage and how these fellows did what they were trained to do and in the process saved the lives of 60 men. See, I'm a storyteller. I love these stories.
Well, you know, I was going to say in my limited experience of submarine stories, some of the most tense television programs I have ever watched have been stories of what went on in a submarine. And I can't remember the names of the movies, but I just remember watching them and remembering that it's kind of that pain you endure, you know, during a tense movie. It's kind of like you can't stop watching, but you're your heart.
Well, and that's part of the thing. I think people have a natural fascination for submarines just because it's so unnatural for people to do what these guys do.
This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antenna's TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? Then what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. Have you been looking for a place to put a website? Have you thought about putting your own website up, or possibly you've got your own right now and you're not real happy? The name to think about and remember is tux-support.com. Tux like tuxedo, the little penguin, the mascot for Linux, the Linux operating system. Tux-support.com. Just remember that name. If you're looking for a website for your amateur radio club, your church, your organization, your business, or even a personal site, you need a place to put that site, and you want a simple way to put it together and maintain it. One word or one company to remember, that's tux-support.com. Tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. Tux-support.com. The only name you need to know when it comes to your website. I found this vitamin put out by the Premier Micronutrient Corporation. And it's a different vitamin than I'd ever taken before. Matter of fact, it'll be a different vitamin than you've ever seen. Metabolic has all kinds of things going for it. Number one, first off, it was designed correctly, not like vitamins you buy in the supermarket or off the shelf. It's known that water-soluble micronutrients have a half-life of 4 to 6 hours, and fat-soluble constituents have a half-life of 6 to 8 hours. So it only makes sense To maintain a steady state of proper antioxidants in your body, the supplements have to be taken twice a day. There's no other way. You want to take a vitamin that actually makes you feel different? You need Metabolic. Now Metabolic and another formula they make called Veterans Formula, they don't contain iron, copper, or manganese. Now, these minerals are known to interact with vitamin C, and they produce excessive free radicals if they're in your vitamin supplement. And this production of free radicals caused by this combination is in more than 95% of the commercial vitamins that you'll find on the supermarket shelf. It's exactly the opposite of what you want. In addition, these minerals, especially iron, can be dangerous, because men of all ages and women after menopause don't excrete iron in any significant amount. And that excess of iron in your system causes more free radicals. Diabetes and high blood pressure, that's the formula for you. There's also the Veterans Formula. What you need to do is go to the website and take a look. It's pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. Very simple to remember. Believe me, you take Metabolic or Veterans Formula for 2 weeks, and you will be a different person. Take a look on the website. Go visit the website at pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. You're listening to QSO. It's All About Ham Radio, brought to you by Transworld Antennas, Heil Sound, Gigaparts, PMC Science, Tux-Support.com, Markham Street Films, and Martin Lynch & Sons, your European distributors for the finest in amateur radio equipment. This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC.
And that's why I think they make such great stories. They bring out the best and the worst in people, there's no doubt about it. I did have a ham radio connection here, though. The Ice Diaries was commemorating an event that happened exactly 50 years ago. And last August, we put together a special event station, November 9, from the Submarine Force Museum and historic ship Nautilus, which is still around and open to the public, in Groton, Connecticut. And we operated all weekend up there, and with a lot of help from the Navy Marine Corps Mars guys, we used their emergency trailer and their portable 50-foot tower and their three-element 20-meter beam, and we put that thing on the air for that weekend and made over 2,000 QSOs and had a great time commemorating that 50th anniversary. And one of the real cool things that happened is during the special event, I got an email from a fella, AC3Q, and he asked if we were going to do any CW. And I said, well, we had not planned on it. We've got a Keir here, but we're getting in so many logbooks on sideband with just two stations, I think we're probably just going to stay on sideband. He said, okay, thanks. Well, on the Sunday afternoon, there in the pileup, I hear AC3Q calling me. And he had already told me what the connection was, so as soon as I heard him, I said, hey, we're switching to CW right now. And we carried on a little exchange there, and it turns out we were commemorating something very special. When Nautilus first emerged from beneath the ice pack after reaching the North Pole, she surfaced and was trying to radio back word that she had successfully made it across the top of the world. President Eisenhower, three or four admirals at the Pentagon, they were all holding their breaths because this is the world's most famous vessel, and she had certainly done something extremely dangerous, and they were wanting to get word. So they word back. Nobody would answer them because, as a lot of hams know, in the upper latitudes, propagation is terrible. But they finally raised the Pearl Harbor naval station, naval radio station, and they acknowledged receipt of the message Nautilus 90 North, which confirmed that they had made it to the 90th degree of latitude, which is the North Pole. One of the operators that day at Pearl Harbor, who heard that historic message and relayed it onto the Pentagon, was AC3Q. So we relived that incident almost exactly 50 years after it happened. And that was really the highlight of the weekend. If any of your listeners subscribe to the K9YA Telegraph newsletter, I don't know if you get to see it or not, Ted, but it's a great newsletter delivered in PDF over the Internet. There's an article in there about that event that I wrote for them in the current issue.
Well, you know, I was going to say the significance of that. A lot of folks that are listening now, either that don't remember it or don't know anything about it at all, maybe you want to give us a little rundown on Nautilus's course and why that became such a a milestone to go down in history.
Well, what you have to remember is in 1957, America needed heroes in the worst way, because the Russians just launched Sputnik, that we mentioned earlier. A lot of the countries in the world were of the impression that U.S. technology was suffering, that if technology was going bad for the United States, then military wouldn't be far behind, and immediately started questioning their alliances, whether they might should cozy up to the Soviet Union. And President Eisenhower was looking for something that would show the world that America was still capable of doing spectacular things. And just a chance meeting between President Eisenhower's naval aide, Pete Durant, and Captain Anderson on the steps of the Pentagon led to Nautilus being called upon to go beneath that ice pack where nobody had ever gone before. And they had no idea what they were going to run into, what ice conditions were like or how deep the ocean was or any of those things. To make that run across the top of the world. Now, that was primarily just to show the world that we could accomplish things. It did a lot of other things, because it showed the Russians that we could operate in their backyard with a nuclear submarine. And it proved that they could shave a lot of hours off the trip from Tokyo to London. A submarine in the Atlantic fleet could now go beneath the ice pack and come out in the Pacific if need be, and several days shorter trip than having to go through the Panama Canal. And if you go through the Panama Canal, everybody in the world can see that you're going through there. Not the case with going beneath the ice pack. So for a lot of reasons, it was an extremely important turning point in the Cold War.
This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. Week after week, you hear us talk about trans-world antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW-2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW-2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW-2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. I found this vitamin put out by the Premier Micronutrient Corporation, and it's a different vitamin than I'd ever taken before. Matter of fact, it'll be a different vitamin than you've ever seen. Metabolic has all kinds of things going for it. Number one, first off, it was designed correctly, not like vitamins you buy in the supermarket or off the shelf. It's known that water-soluble micronutrients have a half-life of 4 to 6 hours, and fat-soluble constituents have a half-life of 6 to 8 hours. So it only makes sense to maintain a steady state of proper antioxidants in your body. The supplements have to be taken twice a day. There's no other way. You want to take a vitamin that actually makes you feel different? You need Metabolic. Now Metabolic and another formula they make called Veterans Formula, they don't contain iron, copper, or manganese. Now, these minerals are known to interact with vitamin C, and they produce excessive free radicals if they're in your vitamin supplement. And this production of free radicals caused by this combination is in more than 95% of the commercial vitamins that you'll find on the supermarket shelf. It's exactly the opposite of what you want. In addition, these minerals, especially iron, can be dangerous, because men of all ages and women after menopause don't excrete iron in any significant amount. And that excess of iron in your system causes more free radicals. Diabetes and high blood pressure, that's the formula for you. There's also the Veterans Formula. What you need to do is go to the website and take a look. It's pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. Very simple to remember. Believe me, you take Metabolic or Veterans Formula for 2 weeks, and you will be a different person. Take a look on the website. Go visit the website at pmcscience.us. That's pmcscience.us. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
Glenn Dustin from Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, Bubba!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen. Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert, cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to the vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big HCKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big 8 from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big 8 is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. The Motor City.
This week on QSO, our guest is Don Keith, N4KC. Now, that's very interesting. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you recall a song, an instrumental song, that was called Nautilus? I don't know how big a record it was. I just remember it from being a kid. Do you remember that song by any chance?
I don't remember that song.
Okay. It was flip side, I believe, of a song called Nut Rocker by B. Bumble and the Stingers.
Now, that song I remember.
Flip side was a song called Nautilus. And, of course, they did their best to put in some sort of effect or something to simulate, an atomic-powered submarine. But I think that's significant because that comes back to me as a kid listening to that song and wondering and I guess exploring at that time what seemed to be a magical world of a nuclear powered submarine, you know. And of course that was something that no one had ever really contemplated, you know, as to nuclear power. And which you heard these stories, this submarine can operate indefinitely, you know, it can just go anywhere and do anything. And
yeah, it can stay submerged until they run out of food. That's the limiting factor.
So anyways, but that's amazing. It really is. And to think we go back that far, that amateur radio played a key role in that, in getting word back that Nautilus had reached its destination point safely. And once again, where you have amateur radio, you know, impacting history, something that folks probably don't know that much about. I can just imagine what was going through your head when you heard that CW call coming through.
Yeah.
Knowing the background of it, you're right. It's just like reliving the original situation, you know, or having at least vicariously participated in the event.
I would highly recommend anybody who finds themselves in the Groton, Connecticut area. The Submarine Force Museum is there right next to the New London sub base. And they've got the Nautilus, which is one of only two historic ships. The other is Old Ironsides in Boston. And it's free. You can actually tour this thing free. There have been several other stations that have operated from there, but it's been a long time. And we talked to so many people during that special event weekend who either had... their parents had worked on Nautilus, or they were submariners and things like that. It was just a wonderful weekend. Of course, it took me a long time to get all those QSL cards returned. I'm still returning them even now, 6 or 7 months later.
Well, that's fantastic. We need more stuff like that. These special event stations, I think, are really cool because it combines history and heritage. Along with the hobby, and opens the doors and opens the imagination as well.
Yep, absolutely. If anybody's interested, by the way, in that special event, some of the things behind it, I've got a link on my website at n4kc.com.
Well, you have a ham radio blog up there as well. Tell us a little bit about the blog.
Well, this was an idea I had a while back, and it's sort of taken off. I read an article in a magazine somewhere on an airplane about how rapidly technology is changing. And this article made the statement that technology itself, technological knowledge, doubles every 5 years. Medical knowledge doubles every 3 years. And I got to thinking, you know, my parents didn't handle change very well, and it was virtually slow back in those days. Imagine what it must be like for older people, even us baby boomers, as rapidly as things are changing, and what effect does that technological change have on society? Since my background is media, I thought, you know, how about media? And then I start looking at our wonderful hobby of ham radio. What changes with the software-defined radios, with the digital modes now being... so popular. What effect is all this having on the hobby of ham radio? Guys who fought over AM and single sideband, what would they think today with Pactor, PSK-31, RIDI without the old machine, all those things. So I created this blog, and I try to keep up with some of the technological change that's going on, and I talk about it and have folks comment on it, and it's really been a lot of fun. It's n4kc.blogspot.com.
N4KC.blogspot.com.
Right.
And I'd like to invite folks to check that out. You know, that's something else that's kind of let me get your take on this. We did an interview with a fellow who just started 73s.org, which is a ham radio version of Facebook. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a young fellow by the name of Chris Matthew. And immediately after he had introduced this site, there was a big controversy that occurred on EHAM where these guys were saying, well, it's the proper term is 73. The proper term is not 73s. And I thought, you know, a good portion of these guys are folks that couldn't upload their picture to QRZ if their life depended on it, you know.
And they're worried about the extra S.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I guess... And I went up to 73s.org, and it was very interesting. Now, here's new technology. I mean, we've got a ham radio Facebook now. I think that's just so cool, you know.
I think it's great.
And I hear guys saying things like, well, you know, Echolink is not really ham radio. And I don't know. I don't know what to think about that because I say, yeah, it is. You know, I mean, it's like it's as crazy as saying, I mean, if you grew up in the broadcast business, You know, I came up, like you did, playing 45 RPM records. You know, and our predecessors played 78 RPM records on great big gigantic transcription tables. Took up half the room, you know. And consoles that had tubes in them. And preamps that had tubes in them. And all that sort of thing, you know. Would you want to go back to that?
I think there's a certain mentality. It's human nature where certain people resist change because they're afraid of it. They're afraid that they won't be able to adapt to it, or they're afraid it's going to change things too much or whatever. I'm sure if you went back to the old days when AM first came along, the CW guys said, oh, no, we can't do that. That's not ham radio. And as we've talked before, we talked with AM and single sideband, or, you know, carrier AM as opposed to single sideband, the big controversy that happened, the whole two-meter FM thing and VHF and UHF FM, people thought, ah, that's not ham radio because they're using FM. That's always going to be a factor. It's human nature because people are afraid of things they don't really understand.
Well, I remember the transition of going into a station where all the music had been on carts, but put on carts. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't any more 45 RPM records in the studio, and all of a sudden,
no cue burn.
Yeah, the turntables disappeared out of the radio stations, you know, and then you could set these cart machines up so that one would fire another one, you know, that kind of thing. You could actually walk out of the studio for a few minutes if you had to, you know. And then of course we went from carts, music on cart, to music directly on CD, and then the computer came along. And I remember my first PC, I remember going out and buying a 40-megabyte hard drive, thinking, I'll never fill that up, you know. And the machine I'm running today that I do most of my audio editing on has, like, 3-terabyte machines on it, 3-terabyte drives on it. And I'm running out of space. I still don't have enough room. I don't care how many terabytes you throw in a machine. You will run out of space. That's just all there is to it. And so, you know, working with radio automation, the very first ones were all the music, all the commercials, everything is on hard drive. And my son, my one son, Matt, works for Dave Ramsey. He's Dave's chief.
Sure, I know Dave.
He's the chief engineer. And now they're on 400 radio stations and on Fox Television. And all the video now, everything, all the video is edited on a computer and all this kind of stuff. And it's marvelous because they can do all kinds of things. I mean, one little old computer box sits there and it just crunches away and it does all kinds of amazing things, you know. And, if you were to go back and visit yourself, a vinyl record studio on the air,
mm-hmm.
and someone were to play a video for you and show you what was coming up, I don't know that you nor I, either one, would be able to conceive or even handle it. I mean, we'd be looking at that going, the first thing probably out of my mouth would be, well, that'll never work. You know, that,
right.
Yeah, that'll never happen. Nah. It's just,
but you know what? I could tell you what color the label was for every hit song from 1966 through about 1987.
Exactly.
I could tell you how long the intro was, too, because you get to talk up to the post on the intro of the record.
Yeah, they use some of the record companies actually print the intro time on the copies. And I remember the green and yellow chart record labels and what the old RCA labels looked like, and Decca, and later on, of course, MCA, and all these. Yeah, you get to know the artist associated with the label. There's a little bit of that's missing, because it, you know, on a computer, all you see is the title of the song, the intro, the artist, and there's not a label logo, there's not any of that stuff. So there's some things that are missing. But after working with software automation inside of a radio station and seeing the versatility that it has. But unfortunately, I think what we've done is we've gone backward on the other side. We have all this new technology. Now the human element has disappeared. We've almost all but eliminated the human being from the process.
And I'm not a Luddite. I embrace change. I think change is a good thing in a lot of cases. But I think when you start taking the human element out of it, then we become very cold and very brittle. You know, I hear people describe CD when CDs first came out as the sound not being warm and full, but being brittle. And I think that's exactly what happens when you take the human element out of change.
Yeah, and my first impression of a compact disc was, boy, there sure isn't any noise, but something isn't right.
Mm-hmm.
Or did you have that impression the first time you heard?
Exactly.
You know?
That's exactly it. I think I can still tell the difference between an old turntable with a good system and a CD or any kind of digital audio.
You're
compressing sound and decompressing it, uncompressing it, and you're making changes and artifacts in that music.
Well, yeah, and of course, today we live in an MP3 world. You know, of course, that technology has come along rather marvelously, because I can take an MP3 player, if you want to call it that, an iPod or a Zune, and plug it into a high-end stereo system, and it's pretty impressive. It doesn't sound as good as the original vinyl on a really good turntable. But I got into a conversation with my son about that the other day, and I said the problem with a really, really good turntable and cartridge and a good preamp and a good, you know, good amplifier and high-end speaker system is you will find that out of your vinyl record collection, you can probably only stand to listen to 2 out of 10.
Yeah.
And I always love the Moody Blues, you know, and I've got all their vinyl, and it's horrible audio. It really is. I mean, you're better off listening to it on an AM radio or an FM radio with some limitations on the response, because you become overcritical. The human element. You're writing books, so to you can really relate to that human element far more than a lot of people probably could, because as you're following this timeline in a book, you have to get into all the nuances of the human side of a story.
Yeah, and that's it, and that's exactly what I was talking about with submarines. And you said it. I'm not writing about the hardware. I'm writing about the people that are inside the hull of that submarine who's operating the hardware, and that's important to me because that's where the stories are. Yeah, they use this stuff to sink a Japanese aircraft carrier, or they use this amazing science fiction-like vessel that was named after a science fiction vessel, the Nautilus, and they take it to places where man has never gone before, the last frontier. But those were humans who did that. Those were the admirals in the Pentagon who literally risked their careers on sending Nautilus to the North Pole. Dwight Eisenhower, who risked his political career to send the most famous vessel in the world to a place where they really weren't sure if they would come back or not. But they felt it was, that's what they had to do. And that's where the story is, pushing men to their limits, seeing how they react under pressure, and that's what I love to write about.
Well, you know, we get exposed to a good deal of that. I guess I want to say the human element side. In amateur radio, especially when you get into activities like field day or any sort of emergency exercises, and then if it's not the emergency exercise, it's the actual emergency itself, you know, that takes place. And with all the technology we've got, I think we have actually become more vulnerable. A good snowstorm blows through and your cell phone, you might as well just put it in your pocket.
Yeah, you learn to depend on technology, and it may not be as dependable as we think it is.
And I've often wondered, you know, what will happen if we get something like a coronal mass ejection or something takes place on the sun. That could be something rather routine. I mean, something that's happened an untold number of times. It's just that we're in a window now where it's not happened. And something takes place like that and just knocks every satellite completely dead. you know, is that not going to be a rude awakening to the society in which we live?
Oh, sure it is. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's where we're going to need somebody who actually remembers the Morse code and little things like that, because that may be the only way we can get through.
That's true, because a CW transmitter is something that's, you can almost scrounge up parts to build. You know, I mean,
plus you can build one in an Altoid can. I've done that.
Yeah, I guess what I'm looking at, though, is the fact that, once again, you take that technology away, and what are we back to? We're back to a bunch of human beings, a bunch of humans that have stories, that have emotions, that have all these things that make us human. And I think that it's kind of a sobering thought. That's one thing about amateur radio that I've noticed, and it kind of redirects your focus. Not that you're running around expecting the sky to fall every day, but you're kind of prepared in case it does, you know, and you get back to that same basic thing, and that is we're just a bunch of people is what we are. And
that's one of my favorite activity at ham radio. I do contesting, and I love DXing. I like doing mobile VHF on 2 meters, all those things. But my favorite activity in ham radio is still rag chewing. I love just getting on the air, meeting people. Maybe I just have a natural curiosity about people, but I want to hear what their story is. I want to hear what they do, where they live, what their thoughts are on things. And just settle in on 40 meters and call CQ and somebody comes back. I've had the most marvelous conversations and met the most interesting people doing that. And that's why I keep going back to that. That's why you may hear me calling CQ this weekend on 40, because I just want to meet you and talk to you. I really enjoy that.
Well, you know, it's amazing. When I was a kid living in Detroit, my first experience with ham radio was a fellow by the name of Nelson Cosby. And he kind of introduced me to it. We went into his basement, and the first time I ever laid eyes on a Heathkit Marauder and an SX-101 and all those kind of things that he had. But he made a statement that was kind of interesting. He said, one of the things that I enjoy the most about ham radio is, he says, I always ask the person on the other end, what is it that they do for a living? What is their occupation? And he said, I ask them about their family. And that kind of stuck with me. And it's very difficult for me now to get into a QSO with someone without asking them about their occupation. You know, it's so hard to not do that, you know. Sometimes the answers you get, you're really amazed at what they do and who you're talking to.
Yes.
And not that a person has to have some unusual occupation, but you'll talk to people from all walks of life that do everything imaginable. You'll find out about professions that you didn't even know existed. And tell me a little bit about your operating. I mean, you're a storyteller. Tell me a little bit about some of the folks you've met on amateur radio.
Well, just a couple of weekends ago, I had a good conversation with a fellow who was a retired college professor. He had taught physics in college for 30 years, and he retired. I've got a good friend who I've met via ham radio who lives out in Arizona now. He was a professor at the University of New Orleans for a number of years and has written 5 best-selling books about money management and how to have a successful business and that sort of thing. He's an avid DXer, and we compare notes and different antennas and different tuners and things like that. Even right here in Birmingham, there's a fellow who was a television engineer. He was a television cameraman way back during the 60s, during the Civil Rights Movement. And if you see those pictures from Birmingham, when Martin Luther King was leading the marchers through the streets of Birmingham and they were blasting people down with fire hoses, Ed, W4ZSB, was the fellow who took that film that's still being shown. And they're all around us. Everybody in ham radio has a story of some kind. Now, I know some people they feel more comfortable talking and that sort of thing, and they're not aren't the greatest conversationalists, and they'd rather wire up capacitors and resistors than talk on the air. That's fine. That's the beauty of our hobby, is there are so many different aspects to it. But if you just get on the air and if you just talk to folks, you're going to meet absolutely fascinating people.
You know, and we've had, I mean, it isn't. I don't want to take anything away from this at all, but I mean, it isn't just folks like Ronnie Millsap, who is extremely interesting to talk to and probably an incredible find as far as being on the air and actually meeting this guy and talking to him. But it's everybody that's on there. I guess that'll raise another question. You say you author. Now, as an author, you do this kind of part-time. What do you do for a living? What is your profession? What have you found your way into?
Well, I fell into another job accidentally. I was working for the Arbitron Company, and I was traveling 50 weeks out of the year, and I had a couple of book projects underway, so I decided I'd enjoyed as much of the travel as I could stand. So I left Arbitron and was going to take a year off and finish up those books. Well, in the meantime, I was approached by a career college who had heard about an idea I had about teaching people the intricacies of buying and selling advertising. And they asked me to come start a program doing that, which I did. And they said, well, since you know something about advertising, maybe you can kind of look at our plan and make sure we're on target and all that sort of thing. Next thing I knew, I was teaching, plus I had a 60-hour-a-week job running the advertising for a chain of career colleges. And that's what I do today. We're sort of on the cutting edge of education because employers today don't necessarily want folks with a well-rounded education. There's certainly a place for that. What they want are people who have the skills necessary to be good employees in the medical field, medical assisting, diagnostic sonography, nursing, criminal justice, computer networking, and things like that. And that's what our schools do, is teach people what they need to know to be successful in those careers. And I handle their advertising and marketing. And we also have a chain of golf schools that teach people the business of golf and prepare them for careers in the golf industry. And you may see commercials for that school, the Golf Academy of America, as well as our online school, Virginia College Online, nationally. But we advertise very heavily in the markets where we have campuses, Birmingham, Huntsville, Alabama, Austin, Texas, Jacksonville, Florida, Greenville, South Carolina, places like that. So it's a very satisfying job because we see people come in and they emerge with a new self-confidence because they're able to do something they never thought they could do before.
Okay, now, you know, you're a professional now as far as, I mean, you have a real handle on career development, obviously, at this point. And I think you're right. I mean, I keep hearing more and more about outsourcing and large companies who will hire a company that hires experts. Now, these guys may be people who never completed college but are really good in a particular field. They go to work for a company, and that company gets outsourced to do a particular job, and they're really not looking for someone as much with a degree as they are the people with the capabilities. And with that in mind, I have two sons that have wound up in radio engineering as chief engineers of stations or operations. David is with Trevecca Nazarene University, and of course I told you about Matt being with Dave Ramsey. Amateur radio has really paved quite a path for these two young guys. With all the hands-on experience they have had working in amateur radio, has really opened a lot of doors to them. Matter of fact, you know, they refer to Matt as being MacGyver. You know, make anything work. You know, under any circumstances. You know,
An airplane out of a paperclip.
There you go. And because we are all in amateur radio, and of course this radio show is about amateur radio. How do you see ham radio preparing or helping develop young people into a career path?
Well, I tell you what I've seen firsthand in myself and in a lot of other guys like me. I think the number one thing, yep, you can learn electronics, you can develop an interest for technology, and learn. And it's almost a skill being able to learn new technology, and I think ham radio is great for that. But at the same time, it teaches you to communicate. It teaches you the basic skills that you need to be able to express yourself, to be able to carry on a conversation, to be able to explain yourself, to be able to write a paper or a PowerPoint presentation that explains how a piece of technology works. I think that's the big thing. It helps you challenge or channel that ability to communicate. That's kind of an esoteric thought, but I think that's the big thing about ham radio, and I think that's how it can prepare people for a career.
Well, in terms of Elmering, And some of the folks out there that have not taken on a young person or taken on even an older person to get them into the hobby, if you're wanting to make an investment as far as people are concerned, and you want to make an investment in society in general and with young people, what advice would you give to someone who is thinking along that lines as an Elmer? What would you say to those folks?
Well, you know, first of all, I see all these topics on eHam about how we should be selling this thing. We should be grabbing everybody by the collar and shaking them and telling them how they should be a ham radio operator and enter amateur radio as a hobby and that sort of. I don't necessarily agree with that. But I think if you see that spark in somebody, you see that interest, then nurture that. It's not hard to spot. You can see the look in their eye when at field day if they wander over from the playground and they want to know what those radios and what those antennas are. You can see that interest there. If you will nurture that, not in a high-pressure way, then I think we're going to pick up a lot more people who will see the same thing that you and I saw in this hobby and have never looked back. We desperately need Elmers. I think the whole Elmering process has changed thanks to the Internet. Sites like eHam or QRZ.com, places like that, they have forums where people can get on there and ask their dumb questions, and just like you and I did, and get them answered hopefully in a rational way. I get a little irritated sometimes when guys snap back that you should know that if you pass the exam and that sort of junk. Hey, these guys want to know, and they're willing to step up and ask the questions. Then answer those questions to the best of your ability. The whole tradition of Elmering, I think, is as strong as ever, and it's just as important as ever.
You know, when you were talking about, you know, one of the most favorite things that you like to do on ham radio is rag chew. And also being somebody that's written a number of novels, and you deal with marketing and all that sort of thing. An area that I'd like for you to address, and we're running close on time, and I know you've got to go. What about on the air? What about on the air? I mean, one of the problems that I see is there's a lot of guys. You know, I noticed this one fellow that's doing some of the amateur radio podcasts. He developed a podcast on mic fright. And there's a
lot. Pick up a CW key then.
the point is that why don't you give some pointers on rag chewing? Why don't you give a few pointers on how do you make a successful QSO and leave that QSO in such a way that the person is going to want to talk to you again and is going to remember you down the log?
I remember about 30 years ago, my dad, who was a ham as well, I took him to Opryland in Nashville. He walked in the gate. He didn't look at the rides. He didn't look at the concession stand or watch the shows. He went over and sat down on a bench, and everybody who sat down next to him, he would strike up a conversation with those folks. He was interested in people. I think I inherited that bug. He didn't care who they were. He wanted to find out about them, where they were from, what they did, what interesting had happened to them, who they knew, what common ground they had. And the two biggest tips I can give you, I think, came straight from him. First of all, be interested in other people. If you're not interested in other people, you're not going to be a great rag chewer, I'll tell you. Secondly, establish some common ground. People love to have something in common with somebody. And I assure you, I used to do this little things when I traveled so much. If somebody sat next to me in a seat, if they looked like they wanted to talk, I would start talking with them, and you would be surprised how quickly we could establish common ground. They knew somebody I knew. We had been to the same restaurant in a city somewhere. We shared a hobby or a movie we had seen recently or something. And when you do that, people immediately feel comfortable. They have an affinity for you, and the next thing you know, you're enjoying yourself, and they are too. Just on a practical side, as you're talking to somebody on the air, make notes. Write down some questions you want to ask. Even us old guys, we especially have to do that. But, you know, if somebody mentions something that's interesting to you, make a little note there that you want to mention that when you go back to them. I ragged you both ways, where you're just chatting back and forth just like you were sitting on that park bench, or where you make a transmission, the other station makes a transmission and that sort of thing. But if you're doing the transmission thing, then make some notes and talk to him about what he said and that things that piqued your interest. And people appreciate being asked about those things, and they'll come right back at you, and you'll enjoy it just as much as they do.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you joining us today. You've had some very interesting stories to tell. And briefly, just before we run along here, why don't you give the folks kind of a rundown on the current books that are available that you've authored, and where they can get those, and let's also give out your website again so that folks can get involved in the N4KC Ham Blog.
Sure, and they're all available. All the submarine books. I've got the submarine novel Final Bearing is out there still. And by the way, we've got a movie deal, and it's on an unpublished submarine novel, and we're hoping to be able to announce the director and the stars on that very shortly. But probably the easiest thing is just go to donkeith.com or n4kc.com. That's November 4 Kilo Charlie, n4kc.com. And the books are available wherever books are sold.
All righty. And I appreciate your time, and this has been a very interesting interchange, or a very interesting QSO. and I really want to thank you for coming on board. I'd like to have you back soon, and maybe by then you'll have written a couple of more books that you can talk about, and we'll have some more interesting stories to tell.
Makes me tired thinking about writing all those books. But, Ted, it has absolutely been a pleasure. 73 or 73s, whichever you prefer.
Well, thank you so much. That's going to do it for this edition of QSO. We want to say thanks to our guest, Don Keith, N4KC. Once again, tune in next week, same time, same station, for QSO.